Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, we've officially reached August, which means I'm going to run down the August calendar to start with. This Saturday is our X-Wing night. Right. You bring a force of 100 points, maybe bring about 300 if you have that made to bring, because they might play a bigger game. Yeah. Starts at 5:30, runs till about 9. Should be a lot of fun, and we're hoping to get a good turnout for that.
It seems like I've had a lot of people asking about it, yeah. So I think interest is high, and I want to see some dogfights going on.
In the game.
Not illegal dogfights.
Okay, yeah. Then that next Tuesday is Reading with Rogues. We're going to be talking about Watchmen and Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad, as of today, or actually as of yesterday, is 15% off, 25% if you have a rogue card. That is the Ostrander Suicide Squad Trial by Fire, I believe is the name of the trade.
Yep.
And we all recommend that book.
Yeah, that was a absolute formative book for me in like 87 or whenever when it launched. I think it was 87.
Then Gaming with Rogues is August 20th. We're going to be playing Pandemic, the classic cooperative game. And then that next Wednesday, August 24th, will be the release of Blue Beetle Rebirth number 1, which we have Cully Hamner, who is both one of the variant cover artists and the co-creator of the character, coming out to a signing from like 12:30 to 1:30 that Wednesday.
And like an excellent character designer and just artist
in
his own
right. Cully's a great artist, yeah.
Been around since kind of big since the 90s, I guess. Yeah. I don't know if he's been around since before that.
Probably.
But I'm looking forward to it.
So we have a lot of news this week. This is not like the flood of San Diego news last week. It's a bit of a mixed bag of weird TV and game news. So we're just going to run through it. There'll be no particular theme.
Cool.
So let's start. I'm just going to go in order of what I've got written down. So Geoff Johns is president of DC Comics.
Yes.
Or DC Entertainment.
DC Entertainment.
What does that mean?
We don't know.
But it seems like he's ahead of the film side of things now.
Yeah, basically it seems like he's in charge of the films.
Does he have any presence in their comic side of things right at the moment?
Sounds like no.
Okay.
I think like he's still chief creative officer. He still builds that.
Yeah, but what is he doing? Because he can't be doing both. There's not a lot of time.
He might be like big picture guy.
Yeah.
Like when they're doing whatever their planning thing is, he walks in and he's like, what if Mogo attacked?
He's like, how about this? Let's have Superman not step on any orphans this week. And they're like, all right, scratch that story.
I looked at the credits. He is still listed as chief creative officer.
So that's just like the most recent. I mean, you know, this may not show up in...
No, I think Nick is right. I think he's both.
I think he's apparently been the head of the movie stuff for a little while now.
Yeah,
it just wasn't announced.
That's the weird thing about this story. That's what makes it interesting is that this promotion happened like a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of trickled out. Like, there was no announcement or anything. It's just like, oh, by the way, he's been in charge for a month.
Huh.
And a lot of people are sort of guessing that that's because we got sort of more lively things from San Diego for the movie side of things. Like, the Justice League sizzle reel had a little bit more humor and a bit more things.
See, this is the thing that people do, and I don't know how much I buy it. It's possible, but every time somebody's going right for DC, everyone would be like, oh, that's Geoff Johns getting involved. And he's been involved there for like 20 years, so you've got to give him the blame for the bad stuff too.
The good and the bad.
Oh, I do. I totally do. I know a lot of people just say that, but I can see some of his humor after reading a lot of his work for the past couple of years.
I don't know if it was Geoff Johns though, because nobody's arm got ripped off, and there were no Nazis. So
you don't know. There could have been secret Nazis in there.
But it's an interesting thing. I mean, we usually Marvel. Usually when they do their promotions, they trumpet them from the rooftops, even if it's kind of a meaningless thing. And I'm surprised that DC isn't doing the same thing. Like, hey, you know that guy you all love? He's in charge of our movies now. It's kind of a weird thing to quietly promote him. But I don't know. It's interesting. Moving on, we've got the new trailer from another controversial figure, M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh, yeah.
He has a new trailer that Dave pointed us to called Split.
Yes.
Who is the actor in this? I can't remember who it was. Is it James McAvoy?
Yes, it is. It's Professor Xavier.
And I believe, and I could be wrong, I didn't look up on IMDb, I think one of the girls in it is actually from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. I think she was Zan. She was. Yeah.
She was.
So it's like it looks like three teenage girls get kidnapped by a crazy man.
Like in a parking lot, yeah.
Who seems to have multiple personalities and maybe can even physically change with those personalities, and there might be a monster.
When I was watching the trailer, I watched it like a week or two back, and I actually forget if I saw anything that seemed supernatural, although I think they... Do you think it's actually supernatural, or do you think, though, that it might be like some sort of dream sequence or, you know, their fears manifest?
I will say about this about M. Night Shyamalan. Anything is possible. So it might have been a dream sequence. It does feel like it's got an edge of supernatural, though, because there's definitely certain...
I mean, I will point out the village looked like it had and was supernatural from the trailers and was not.
I will say this. Here's my guess. I believe the twist is that this all takes place in his head, and the three girls are his personality as well, as is a psychiatrist.
That it'll rip off that John Cusack movie.
Yes, that's my guess for what's going on. But it's a creepy trailer. Didn't you see the Visit?
Yeah, did you like it? I did. I thought it was interesting.
But Dave, you haven't.
I haven't seen it yet. Catch it sometime in the next month or two as Halloween approaches.
But we all somewhat like Devil, I think, which was not Shyamalan, but was
his
written.
Story. Yeah.
He wrote but didn't direct.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I actually liked that quite a bit. You know how one of the creepiest things in Unbreakable was that like home invasion sequence.
Yeah,
this is a little creepy too because I saw just the opening of the trailer the other day. I just like stumbled across it somewhere.
Yeah,
didn't rewatch the whole thing, but like the girls are like in the car like waiting for their dad to take him home or whatever.
Yeah,
and you see he's like putting groceries in the trunk and you like see somebody approaching him. And then it just cuts to inside the car, and they're still talking, and suddenly somebody gets in, and he's got, like, a gun or something.
No, he's
like
got tear gas, like mace or something that he sprays.
Oh, yeah. That's, like, even more disturbing.
One of the girls, like, looks out the side view mirror. She sees, like, the groceries thrown to the ground and something like that.
Right.
And then the door opens, and she kind of turns, expecting for her father to be there, and it's just some random guy.
Yeah. It's a kind of – that is a disturbing sort of sequence.
Sure.
I feel like Shyamalan's got a good – knack for finding disturbing sequences. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just
sometimes
just,
his through line is not completely there.
It reminds me the sort of claustrophobia and the dealing with, it reminds me a little bit of what we all liked about 10 Cloverfield Lane too.
Right, and that'll definitely it'll have to live up quite a bit for that for me.
I think McAvoy is a great choice.
Sure,
he's a fantastic actor.
Yeah,
and
he seems like he can do intense, and you see him as several different personalities during there,
like a 9-year-old kid and.
As the mom,
which is a little weird.
Nice little psycho throwback.
Yeah, it's a nice psycho throwback. Yeah,
it's interesting. I remain to be convinced on Shyamalan again, but I'm interested to see where this one goes. It's a good trailer
to some degree. I mean, I guess the Visit must have done okay. It probably was relatively low budget as these things go.
Yeah,
but because there is so much backlash against him, sometimes I wonder how is it he keeps getting work.
I don't know. Maybe he has pictures of someone at Universal or whatever.
It's possible. That'll be the big twist in his next movie. The pictures are revealed.
It's one of those Terry Gilliam things. This is off too many people.
So, S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., a.k.a. the show Randy really wants to stop watching.
And you might have your
it's like because it's like you're beaten down.
It is.
Just in saying it.
It is.
Like, I'm so weary.
This is about the new S.H.I.E.L.D. director.
So
it?
Phil Coulson's been demoted from director back to agent, which actually I'd never liked him being director. No. It didn't make any sense. That's not his strength, and I think that's part of why the show has not been doing as well. I mean, one of the many reasons.
Yeah.
But they've brought in a new director of S.H.I.E.L.D., played by boring actor Jason O'Mara.
You find it boring?
Oh, my God. He's the Eric Bana of TV.
what's he been in? Just
he was
example.
The lead in Life on Mars on the American remake of it. I actually really liked him there.
I find him so boring.
He was also the lead in Terra Nova, the sort of short-lived Fox show.
I believe, Dave, if you're having trouble picturing him, let me help you out. If someone were to say, here is a white man.
I actually did see the article for this, and I was like, I do remember looking at the picture and being like, wait, this is their announcement?
picture the most boring white dude you can picture.
Yeah.
That's Jason O'Mara.
Right. Well, like, you know what? Like, classic Nick Fury is like this kind of grizzled dude with the graying temples and a cigar and an eye patch, and he's colorful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, he's an old white dude, but he's colorful.
But he's colorful,
he's got
yeah.
character.
Yeah.
And I looked at this guy, and I'm like, it's like a bank executive, maybe?
Yeah. It's like if it took Jason Statham and subtracted all his charisma, you get Jason O'Mara.
You know, and the thing is, it could
a new,
maybe
is that a new graph?
Yes.
It's possible this might have something. It'd be interesting. Like they, maybe they're going to do something interesting with it. But as announcements go, it's like a zero.
Yes.
So they're bringing in a new director. They haven't said who he's actually playing.
And a bad CGI ghostwriter.
And a bad CGI
They've
ghostwriter.
They've only said that his character has ties to Marvels from the 1940s.
Okay. Does that just mean that they plucked some name from a comic?
Probably
and
so.
It's like,
However, I did hear some bad news. I don't know if I did a link to it. It does not look like Adrian Palicki is going to return to... Yeah,
they are doing their best to make me not watch the fourth and most likely final season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Mockingbird is probably getting kicked to the curb.
Adrian Palicki has a new show, I'm fine, whatever.
Isn't that Seth MacFarlane's new show?
Yeah, it sounds weird.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I'm excited about that either. Yeah, they made Mockingbird, they put Adrian Palicki in the role... They should have had me forever, but then they put her off the show and they didn't do the spinoff. They've probably lost me.
Yeah.
Rainey, I don't know if this is on your to talk about list, but that losing her actually made me think of this, that I did see it announced that Supergirl will have Calista Flockhart.
That is on my list, yes. Okay. So, yeah, let's talk about that. Calista Flockhart is going to be a recurring guest star,
not as entrenched as a regular.
I think works.
I actually think it's better because a lot of people did not like Calista Flockhart, so those people will be able to come aboard.
Those people were crazy.
That's probably true, but
but they're not going to get inundated with her, and maybe the writers won't like. Sometimes they're a little too into her, maybe.
Yeah.
But I do. I'm one of those who likes her, and so I'm glad she's going to be around.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad she's not just written off entirely.
Well, I feel like Supergirl is going to have a new job and sort of new thing to do, so she's not going to be kind of her cat's assistant anymore.
Right.
So it makes
sense. What is her new job? Like, what would she be
doing? Well, Kat promoted her.
Yeah,
she's not an assistant.
She's a columnist or something?
She's something like that where she actually has to...
She got to write stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. And also in related news, Superman has a bubble butt.
Yeah, I saw this.
You've seen all the pictures of him.
Yeah.
Actually, it's funny. The pictures, the first picture they released, he did not look great. He looked kind of short and didn't have a lot of presence. But in the actual pictures I've seen since of him, like, on set, I'm like, oh, that looks pretty good. It seems like a solid
enough. I do feel bad
for
any actors who put on a superhero costume.
Yeah.
Because A, the internet will destroy them for the costume. B, the internet will destroy them for their you know, everything about their physical appearance.
Yes.
Or how much in this, like, one random still they represent the character.
Yeah. Just,
I feel so bad for them.
Yeah, me too.
I have a feeling this guy is going to be good. And, you know, I thought he looked fine in the shots.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm ready to just see what he can do.
Then we have the Justice League Dark, not trailer, but sort of featurette.
Oh, right. So, yeah, it was like this long 8-minute thing that showed lots of clips, but also, like, storyboards with voiceover. So you were seeing extended scenes sometimes, but not with full animation. And then a lot of the creators talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. What I thought was interesting, and I keep forgetting, every time I see one of these behind-the-scenes featurettes, I forget that Mike Carlin is now, like, high up in DC's animation, which might explain why some of it's kind of boring. Because Mike Carlin shepherded the Superman books in the 90s that were sometimes really good and sometimes really bad.
Yeah, but
he seems really uneven.
I thought the consensus was that a lot of that was pretty good. That was like one of those best eras of Superman.
It was a decent era, but there were some real missteps.
Yeah.
At any rate, this looks kind of like all the direct-to-DC video for me, which is probably pretty polished, but probably not for me.
Yeah, that's sort of how I felt. Nick, did you have a chance to check it out?
I didn't have a chance. I did not watch this one.
I think the most notable thing is that we're seeing Constantine and Swamp Thing and Zatanna and those guys. I mean, Zatanna's been in animation before, but
yeah,
the demon.
Yeah, very front and center.
Like, we haven't seen Constantine in animation before, I don't think. Yeah. I think he's one of
the... they got the voice actor of...
Matt Ryan, yeah.
Yeah, what's his face?
I think that Constantine is verging on being the breakout character for them because for the longest time, a lot of fans knew him.
Yeah.
We knew him from Swamp Thing. We knew him from his own book. We knew Alan Moore created him. Knew Garth Ennis wrote a memorable run. But
can't re-explain him.
But, yeah, the Keanu Reeves is the version people know, but then people had written off because of the Keanu Reeves version.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, he's just a guy with a magic shotgun, and it's an action hero. And a few people really – some people really like that. But I think that kind of like Harley Quinn went from being sort of a fringe character to, like, one of the most popular characters.
Yeah.
Kind of like, I think, Deadshot maybe about to. Like Deadpool did. I think Constantine is on the verge of being a character that a lot of people really like because he's sarcastic. He smokes.
Building.
He wears a trench coat. He's all, you know.
He's the ultimate anti-hero.
Yeah. So I think that this is another step on that road.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think what I want from DC Animation, first is to make movies more for me and not for other people. But that's just a selfish point. But the second thing I want is for them to expand beyond just doing a lot of Superman and Batman stuff.
Right.
And I think Batman and Green Lantern are both in this because they can't fully divorce from
it. It does make sense to have them kind of on the outskirts. The animators emphasized any number of times that they would be kind of doing the things that Batman and Superman kind of couldn't do or wouldn't do or whatever. So it'll probably be a... you know, more of a hard PG-13 than they've been doing, I'm guessing.
But this is what I want. I want stuff that's on more of the fringes of the DC Universe. Justice League Dark, I'd love to see Suicide Squad.
Are they ever going to do the Judas Contract? I've heard it mentioned a million times.
They should. It'd be a perfect one to do. So, yeah, there's lots of stuff, and I would like them to sort of veer away from just Batman, Superman, Flash, and get a little more out there.
Randy, I believe, you know what, I feel like the time is right for Aquaman.
I do too, actually.
In animation, he could flourish in a way that's somewhat difficult at sometimes.
I don't know. Elsewhere. I don't know which story you take.
Yeah, I don't know either. Do you go Barbarian Aquaman to line up with the movie?
Johns run that was sort of well liked?
Right.
There's not like a seminal Aquaman story.
I believe they still are broadly sticking to New 52 era stuff. So that the Geoff Johns version would make the most sense. But they could also kind of, if they wanted to do an original thing, they could go a little Game of Thrones-y and incorporate some of the Peter David stuff.
Yeah.
That's a difficult character. I've actually picked up odds and ends runs of Aquaman since the 90s and have any number of issues that I've liked.
Yeah.
But they don't reach greatness very often.
Right. They're doing a reboot of The Rocketeer. Well, it's sort of a reboot. It is actually going to be sort of a sequel.
Yeah.
So it's like, what, 7 years later?
I think six or seven.
And there's an African-American girl who finds the jetpack. Cliff has gone missing. And she's part of like a squadron, I think, that's going to be the Rocketeers.
Yeah. Oh, that's kind of interesting.
It sounds really good. It's still set in like the 50s. It's set in World War II era or just post-World War II era.
Yep. I know it freaked out the internet white boy contingent.
Yep.
They're like, what?
Yep.
Now, I will say this, as I am a lover of the original Rocketeer and the comics that surround it, Cliff Secord is a character I like and would be happy to see more of, but I also kind of like the idea of his story kind of completing.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind it being passed on and being more of a legacy thing.
Yeah, me too.
I also like the idea of anything that they might do with a squadron.
Yeah.
You know, because I imagine like a few of them might have slightly different tricked out versions of the jetpack. This guy's the stunt guy. This guy's the explosives expert and all that. And I'd be interested to see what kind of personality types they put in their Rocketeer squad.
So sort of a, if Howard Hughes actually figured out how to perfect the rocket.
Right.
Kind of. Because that was the whole thing. It was they couldn't replicate.
Well, they didn't want to replicate it because they were afraid the Nazis would get their hands on it.
Yeah,
right.
So I don't know. I'm curious to see where they go with it. I love the original Rocketeer. I wish that Joe Johnston was going to direct it, but it sounds like he's not.
Can we get a Billy Campbell appearance?
See, that's the thing. I think if you have Cliff Secord sort of retired,
the guy who played him,
having Campbell's still around, he's still good.
I don't know what he's doing.
You know what? You could also bring in what's her name. The actress, I can't say
the
her
Oscar
name.
Winner.
Yeah,
I don't know if she.
Oh, you're
back
right.
For
you're
it.
Right. What is her name? I suddenly can't say it.
Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah.
That was one of her early roles.
She has graduated to being a much more serious actress.
I can't see her doing it.
Campbell has graduated to
TV stuff.
I'm going to say CSI.
He did. He was on the 4400. I think he was one of the main bad guys in that.
Yeah, that's right. He was.
And he's still good. I like him so. I feel like he did a like romantic comedy for ABC like 20 years ago.
It does feel like
once,
he
now and again.
Now and
once again.
That's a get. Or once and again. There was two of them.
It was with Celia Ward.
One was sci-fi and one was not sci-fi. And was more of a straight romance thing. And he was in that
one. And that was with Celia Ward.
He would be excellent for a return role, you know, as like sort of the mentor type guy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in some role I would really like to see.
Or just an Easter egg at the end.
Yeah.
Where he comes and recruits her to the Rocketeer Initiative.
Yeah.
Or if Alan Arkin wants to show back up.
That would be great.
That's right. Peavy.
Yeah, Peavy's awesome.
All right. So Dungeons & Dragons is getting a Middle-Earth supplement. Lord of the Rings via D&D.
Right, and now this is sort of their open license thing.
Yeah.
I kind of was only vaguely aware that they were doing with 5th edition, but I was like, oh, right, I had heard about that.
Right. There seemed to be an expectation in this article that we'd all be super excited about this, mm-hmm. but I'm like, D&D has always been Lord of the Rings with serial numbers filed off, so what's the big deal?
You know, it is and it isn't. D&D is... It stole a lot of the concepts. There's literally, like, was it the Baelor demon and the Balrog, hobbits or halflings, and all that stuff.
It's expanded beyond that.
But, like, as far as the way, say, the magic system works, nothing like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Their conception of a monster-populated world is not... You know, Lord of the Rings really only has a few big monsters around their world, and there's...
It's true.
And, you know, just orc armies, vast orc armies.
Yeah.
So, and tonally, it's very different. I was thinking, I was like, I don't know how they would even pull that off. Like, you know, the spell list, Gandalf, like, either, like, he creates light, or he pushes people away, or he kills a Balrog. Like, that's all his spell list is.
Yeah, here's the thing. I believe that Gandalf is, like, a second-level wizard. He's got all these minor spells.
Well, he seems like the equivalent of, like, a 19th-level fighter, so...
No, I think what he is, he's a second-level wizard and, like, a 15th-level bard. And so he's got a lot of points into bluff and persuasion, and he's really good at convincing people
talking
that
his
he's...
way through stuff?
Yeah.
I think it's my brother who... I didn't read the full article on this, and he was saying that they are, you know... You know, going. You remember the One Ring RPG that came out that kind of only had sort of a cult following, but did seem to be really going out of its way to follow the books and to emphasize that people had like their some sense of I don't remember what they called it, but like their fellowship rating or something like that, where you know your general whether you were falling into moroseness and grim thoughts was a big thing, or whether you know and that's why the Hobbits actually had a real strong effect potentially on people is because they could like, kind of lighten the hearts of them. And I think they are doing things like that. There are, you know, some added stats, and, you know, the same way that Call of Cthulhu, of course, you know, sanity is almost incorporated in almost any Call of Cthulhu-type game, that they're including some sort of fellowship rating in this. So it does seem like they put some thought into it. I would be curious to see how they adapt it, and, you know, whether, like, Gandalf can fight a... what was I going to say?
You know, the thing is...
Umber Hulk.
The thing is, Gandalf... Gandalf is probably not very good in combat, but he has a very specific plus 20 versus Balrogs.
Actually, Gandalf is good in combat. He's a badass fighter.
Yeah, that's
true. He kicks the crap out of anything that comes near him.
So that's now true. We will get the fight of a lifetime of Gandalf versus a beholder.
Yes. You know, there was that video game that came out a year or two back that was basically Assassin's Creed, Lord of the Rings. You were like this part Wraith Ranger.
Yeah, Shadows Over Mordor.
Shadows Over Mordor. I played probably about 3/4 of that before I got bored of it. And they had some new monsters in it, and they all felt like they fit in Tolkien's world. Okay. They were, you know, weird shadow monsters and wolves and some other strange stuff. And it did seem, I was like, oh, you can pad out this world with monsters without just doing, like, say, D&D monsters. So I'd be curious to see if they will do that, invent them, but try and keep them closer to the spirit of it than, say, a rushed monster.
Sure.
Although I do kind of like that idea. Frodo versus the rushed monster.
It hits the ring rusts, problem solved.
Right? It's the explanation they never mentioned. People think the eagles were a problem. What about the rust monster problem?
I feel like the rust monster problem could be like a BIOS in the D&D world.
Or would that become the most powerful rust monster of them all?
Yes. all right. We got photos from Amazon's Tick TV show.
Yep.
This thing looks weird.
I'd already seen some of these.
Yeah, it looks weird. Very kind of realistic.
Darker. It also, I mean, they did say it was going to be more realistic, but here's the weird thing. It also looks like what a basic cable production of the Tick would look like.
Yeah.
Like, the bad guys look so low, so cheap. So
actually, you know what? I thought that, like, some of the guys who were the bad guy agents, I thought they looked, you know, like decent sort of comic book villain, you know, like the equivalent of, like, Hydra agents.
Don't get me wrong. It looks better than Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
Well, the tough thing about this is, without seeing it, without knowing its tone, I feel like any degree of cheesiness could be an asset.
Yeah.
You know, just depends on how they're playing.
But the pedigree behind the camera on this one is so good.
It's really good.
Evelyn,
yeah.
And isn't it Barry Sonnenfeld?
Yeah, I believe so.
I mean, those two people are responsible for a lot of
that ain't no
great
joke.
Entertainment.
You cast Peter Serafinowicz as the Tick, you get at least an episode from me.
Yeah, and this
I'm a little weirded out that we haven't seen Arthur in his costume, and I'm wondering, are they not going to do the costume? Is he going to be like his
be kind of a mid?
I just wonder if he's going to be like his normal buddy.
Maybe Tick has to convince him to do it, and that's like the first season or something like that.
I don't know.
I do think that because Ben Edlund's done stuff with, you know, Firefly and all these other big shows, that he's probably is thinking a bit more in arcs than you would think of, like, the episodic cartoon and probably I never saw the live action one, but I'm guessing
similar,
the previous one was arc. Standalone.
I know he said that he wouldn't have come back to the Tick unless he found a sort of new way of, or a new kind of hook for it.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's something that's would be interesting to explore in sort of the new superhero infused world we've got. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. And especially some of those darker tropes that are out there. Mm. So, it's not something where I can immediately say, this is exciting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it could be awesome.
I'm curious,
It's on Amazon,
or
right?
It could be,
it's going to be Amazon Prime, yeah. Right. So this may be the weirdest story this week. They're doing a remake of Splash.
Yeah.
And Channing Tatum is going to play the mermaid.
Yep. See, that doesn't seem that weird to me.
Does it not? I love the idea.
Yeah.
But it's weird.
I mean, we are in a gender flip Ghostbusters era.
Sure.
I don't know, people like Channing Tatum, is he in fact in that? He was, no.
No.
Who's the dude?
Chris Hemsworth.
Who's the beefcake dude?
Yeah, he's the beefcake dude in Ghostbusters.
Channing Tatum is...
He's the other beefcake dude.
Yeah.
He's got a great sense of humor.
Channing Tatum has shown the ability to laugh at himself. He's also shown he was in Hateful Eight, and he's great there.
Who was he in Hateful Eight?
He was Jody.
I don't remember who anybody is.
He was the brother. Yeah, he was the head of the floorboards. Okay. Yeah.
You know, did he show up near the end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was also in the remake of 21 Jump Street.
Yeah. Which is really good in that. Yeah.
He was.
Now, it's always weird to remake a movie that I consider Splash a very funny movie. I have not seen it in a long time.
It holds up.
But I remember loving it.
Splash holds up really well. I've watched it in the last few years.
I shot with my grandmother.
Wow.
It was a little weird. You know, that movie is slightly risque.
Yeah, a little bit.
And I think she was like, oh my.
I loved that movie. I mean, John Candy is great in that movie.
Oh, man.
Tom Hanks is great in that movie. Daryl Hannah is great in that movie. Yeah. Eugene Levy. It's such if you haven't seen it, go see it.
The racquetball scene alone kills me thinking about it.
Yeah. The scene where young John Candy is throwing change to look up girls' skirts and still doing it 30 years later. it's really good. But I can see a good gender flip. If you're going to remake it, don't just remake it.
Right.
The gender flip seems like a good call if you're going to remake something to do it. And I like the idea.
Yep,
so.
And I'm imagining they'll just as sort of what I haven't seen it, but the new Ghostbusters, I know that has new plot elements. It is not just a repeat of this storyline.
Right.
I assume this will find some new directions and stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't see who was playing the...
I don't think we know yet.
I don't think we know yet. There was a picture.
I could be wrong. I didn't see any...
You'd freak somebody out if it was another dude.
That would be hilarious. I don't think we're quite there yet.
Not yet. In the remake.
Channing Tatum and it's the other guy from 21 Jump Straight.
Jonah Hill?
Jonah Hill, that's the couple.
I would watch the shit out of that movie. If Jonah Hill was the gay guy, who Channing Tatum was the mermaid, I would watch the shit out of that movie.
By the way, Merman, right?
Not Merman. Mermaid. Merman, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Merman was a He-Man villain.
Ethel Merman.
All right. Also being developed, Universal is developing Midnight Nation, JMS's comic from way back when. Straczynski's writing it. And we talked about his Rising Stars, his other book that came out at the same time, is also in development.
That guy's always had like a foot in Hollywood, and occasionally they actually make his stuff.
Yeah. Well, apparently he's been approached by a lot of people wanting to make Midnight Nation. It's the one thing that he didn't want to have made. It was sort of the thing he was keeping safe.
What's interesting is it's the thing
I feel it's pretty cinematic.
I was going to say, of all his properties, it seems much more easy to adapt than Rising Stars.
And I can see it both as a movie or as like a miniseries or as a season-long, you know, thing.
Well, as a notable producer doing it, it's not Gillian.
I don't remember. Let's just quick say what the premise is.
I was
going to
say,
anybody.
This Midnight Nation is like 20 years old. Nobody knows what this book is.
Yeah.
So the premise is... you remember better than me, probably, Dave.
Oh, man. I don't remember. Well, it's a cop.
It's a cop, and he doesn't die.
He gets shot, but he ends up in this weird nether world that's like, it's like our world, but slightly out of sync with it. It's sort of like a ghostly, empty, imagine all the cities empty. The only things that work in there are the things that in our world are broken.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember in the first issue, he goes up to, like, a phone. This was back when there were still, I guess, like, pay phones.
Yep.
They still have pay phones.
Not a lot.
Anyway, he goes up to a pay phone, and somebody tells him he's got to go to one of the ones that's marked broken or whatever. Yeah.
Which would be all of them now.
And he picks it up, and I remember he hears all these, like, creepy demonic voices. Yeah. And he ends up having to sort of take a road trip across this desolate, partially afterlife-y America. It's got it's sort of haunted. It's definitely got a little bit of a slightly Stephen King's The Stand vibe, at least that first half of The Stand where they're traveling. There are other people here, and I think the deal is that people slip into this world when they become forgotten and lost.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a thing where, like, the homeless sort of can vanish.
But also, like, a person who maybe had lapsed into depression and, you know, like, pushed away all their friends and family might just suddenly fall into this world.
Right.
So it was all the damaged people, and I'm like, okay, this is always going to be a timely story. If done right, it has the potential to have, you know, some real emotional impact. The creepy demons in it were scary,
yep.
As I recall, and there's some good emotional beats. I remember, broadly speaking, I quite liked it.
Me too.
I believe at some point he has an advisor who is a biblical guy, blind.
Yeah. You remember this better than either of us.
It's going together as I'm speaking about it, but I'm losing some of
them. I remember that. Was it Gary Frank that did the art?
Gary Frank did great artwork on it.
Yeah, so we may have to pick that graphic novel back up if it's still available, because it was...
You know what? I think it was Lazarus.
I think you're right.
Yeah. I was right. It is Gillian Hurd.
Okay.
Who produced, like, Terminator 2, Aliens.
So this is optioned as a movie?
No, it's actually optioned as a television series.
Okay.
Teaming with Universal.
I feel like that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, I just did. I assumed it was a movie.
And he's writing the pilot script.
Interesting. Yep. Okay.
I think that's going to be... It's a good fit.
That has potential. That has decent potential.
All right, last bit of news, and this is just kind of an announcement. Be aware that Telltale's Batman series that they're doing, their Batman game.
Yeah, Telltale who made the well-known Walking Dead game.
And Fables, Wolf Among Us.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. They've been doing all kinds of
stuff. Their Batman game is drops today, so if you're interested in that, you can go get it today.
You could be Bruce Wayne / Batman
right now.
Right now.
All right. We'll be back in a second to talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, August 3rd, and the last few weeks have been crazy huge weeks.
Yes, true. So is this week.
Flood of week. This week is big, but I think it was a lighter week for a lot of us in terms of stuff like our favorite books and that kind of thing.
Right, right. Not as many of my big books were out.
So yeah, the picks may be a little esoteric this week, but that doesn't mean we don't have them. And I'm going to start off with a bit of an esoteric pick, which is Silk number 11. I've been reading this book. It is Robbie Thompson of Supernatural. The artist was Stacy Lee, although right now the artist on this issue is sometime artist Tana Ford, and I know there's a new artist coming on board regularly.
Yeah.
This book I like, but have not always been sure if I love it. And they just finished a big, like, 10-issue arc where she was undercover, Mockingbird was her handler, she was working with Black Cat, who's a crime lord, and they... So now she's out of that job, and it's sort of a jumping on point. And so in this issue, there's her old boyfriend, who is a ghost, which was an interesting one development.
Who is her old boyfriend?
I don't know.
It's not like somebody like super well known.
No, no, it just shows up here for the first time. And he says, so they have this little introduction with her, and then there's this bit with her and Mockingbird. And there's this bit with her friends. And basically, this is very much like a first issue. They're setting up her status quo, going through what her job is, all that kind of thing.
So this would be one of those excellent issues for somebody to check out if they haven't been keeping up with the book or have fallen off it or whatever.
Yeah. And then it jumps into a story. She's always been looking for her parents. And it jumps into a new storyline where they're going to be doing a little bit more of that. And it seems to be taking her more of a, instead of the sort of spy supervillain, more of a magic direction.
You know, that can be interesting. I remember when JMS actually first came on Spider-Man, and he did the stuff with Ezekiel.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking of Ezekiel a minute ago.
Yeah.
And it was like a kind of a breath of fresh air.
Well,
and
you know,
like at times I was like, okay, he maybe ran with it too much or whatever, but it's fun to put people, take them out of their comfort zone.
I remember Silk is actually tied into Ezekiel.
Yeah,
like she
right.
was the girl that's that he put in a vault to keep her safe.
Does this look like it's dealing with Ezekiel type magic?
No, it doesn't.
Because that's what all the spider hunters.
Yeah, no, this is something new. And I think the interesting thing about this is, I just kind of want to point out a book that I don't talk about a lot, but I've always liked.
Yeah.
So worth checking this out if you've been liking the Spider-Man books. The Silk is a really interesting character. I like what they've been doing with her. Dave, what is your pick?
My pick is a new Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips joint. You know, those guys work together on everything. And they just wrapped up, what, Velvet? No, wait, he didn't draw Velvet.
They just wrapped up the Fade Out, which was their Fade 50s out. Noir.
And is Velvet also wrapping?
Velvet also
wrapping. Although I know it's not Sean Phillips on there.
But it's also Brubaker.
So it's in other words, it's time for some new Brubaker crime stuff. And this one is an interesting new one that is both, I would say, somewhat, to me at least, it seems more personal than some of his. And also a little more out there in the sense that it's also it's another supernatural sort of crossover.
It's more in that Fatale and Sleeper school than it is, say, Fade Out or Criminal.
Right, those ones that are basically realistic noir type pieces. So This one, begins with some very violent moments, but before long we are introduced through flashbacks that kind of overlap each other until a really, I felt like every step of the way I was kind of glued in to this story. You've got a guy who's a graduate student in his late 20s.
Yeah.
And he's kind of been stuck at college a little longer than he meant to. And part of it was because he got kicked out of college for a few years because he tried to commit suicide, I guess.
Yeah, he's got some serious depression issues.
Serious depression issues. It's interesting. Brubaker always writes about these kind of fallen characters.
Yeah.
This guy, I feel, is somehow one of his more approachable ones, maybe just because he kind of overlaps with the typical, what I would think of as the typical geeky or outcasty problems.
Sure.
Which is, this guy has a girl he's crushing on who's sleeping with his roommate, and there's he can't seem to find an equilibrium with her that he's comfortable with, and lots of stuff in his life kind of going wrong. He's just kind of stumbling through it. And then something happens that how much do we want to say about what occurs?
I don't think we're going to do the big reveal, but basically something's going to put him on a path of vigilantism.
Yes, and I know that he said in the backup that this was, they've been exploring a lot of sort of noir and suspense tropes, and this is the exploration of that sort of vigilante
hero. Death Wishes has a piece written in the back here.
Right, and he, this character seems extremely unlikely for it. In fact, they make a point early on of he and his girlfriend at the time getting harassed in the subway,
and
he doesn't feel like he can do anything about it. He's like, I'm not that guy who gets up and gets in the face of somebody who catcalls. And he's really, he can tell that she's pissed about it, and he's hating, mad at himself. And so you can see he does have that percolating anger, but a lot of it's sort of self-loathing.
Yeah.
So he's not the typical, Charles Bronson kind of vigilante by any means.
No, it's a deconstruction of vigilantism in the same way that Brubaker and Phillips always kind of deconstruct noir tropes a little bit.
And it's also, I will say without getting too much into it, it's creepy.
Yeah.
That sort of supernatural element in it is very creepy.
Yeah.
It's beautifully drawn. That kind of goes without saying, I suppose, for Sean Phillips. His city is this, very living, breathing urban environment. And whether it's, a college dorm room or a snow-swept rooftop, with a big cityscape behind it, it's all so believable. It's really grounded. And you want that for Ed Brubaker's writing, which is so kind of down-to-earth and tough itself. But I think the thing for me was that I was fascinated by this lead character.
Yeah.
I think if you had told me about him, I don't know if I would be. It sounds a little noirish, and it could even run the risk of being kind of emo sounding.
So forget everything we just said.
But as presented, he's a fascinating character.
Yeah.
One who's, it's fairly easy to empathize with, even when he's making kind of dumb decisions sometimes. Yep. And it's definitely got that, I want to see what happens next thing too. I'm just like, where is this crazy thing going?
It's on the darker side of their stuff too. It's a dark read.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It's,
I might even call it some of his darkest that he's done.
I don't know. So often he does go to those places.
Sleeper
though.
Was pretty dark.
I mean, Sleeper was dark, but it was dealing with sort of dark superhero.
This feels more in touch with the real world.
It feels more in touch with the real world, and it kind of references real world things going on. So it kind of
right. Well, that's one of the other. I forgot to mention that. Now that you say that, Nick, this guy is also sort of he's directly commenting on kind of current events.
Yeah.
Not quite by specifics, but he's. He's talking about how that feeling of being, that the world is falling apart.
Yeah. But that sort of grounds it in kind of our reality, making it a little bit more darker.
Right. I agree.
Where all of his others have got a bit of fantasticism, they're fantastic. They've got, Cthulhu elements.
But not like criminal, though.
No, criminal. You're right.
I think because this guy is more of a normal guy, the life of an outlaw criminal is still kind of outside of my knowledge. The life of a loser college guy is very much within my sphere of knowledge.
It turns sad so fast.
Anyway, I'm going to go become a vigilante now. I guess what I want to wrap
become
this up.
A vigilante.
Become a vigilante.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I think it's one of his strongest debut issues in a while. So, Kill or Be Killed is the book. I don't even know if I actually said the title.
I'm not sure if you did either, but I want to call you out.
Kill or Be Killed.
Yes.
Just to reiterate, Kill Or Be Killed. That is the title?
Dave is telling you the title of the book, not giving you instructions. I don't know. He's a vigilante now, so I don't really know what he's doing.
And Nick, what do you have on your list?
Nick, Kill or Be Killed.
What about Suicide Squad?
Whoa, it does seem thematic.
No. Yeah, that is my pick. Suicide Squad number... Rebirth number one.
So their special issue?
Yeah, it's their special... I think this week a lot of people will hear a lot of things about Suicide Squad.
Is there a movie coming out?
There might be a movie coming out on Friday. So there's that. But this is the Rebirth issue. It's sort of a... kind of issue where they're just getting the band back together in a lot of ways.
And introducing a new character.
There is a fun conversation between Amanda Waller and Barack Obama.
Yep. Not named, but it's Obama.
Definitely.
I mean, it's definitely Obama.
Also, just as real quick aside, you know how some of these Rebirth specials have been kind of like handoffs from the previous one?
Yeah.
This one very much feels like it could be the issue number one.
Like,
some of them are a little less essential, and I would say if you are interested in this book, go ahead and pick this one. This is the one to pick up.
Yeah, I will also say, having read it and not being a huge fan of Billy Tan's artwork, I wasn't sure I was going to like this. But if you go see the movie, or if you've been seeing the trailers for the movie and that looks good to you, this is pretty much, I think, exactly what you're going to want.
And
I mean, it's basically about getting, you know, the core Suicide Squad team together, introducing a character. But I liked the mission that they were on in this. I thought it was kind of an odd one.
Can we say what the mission is? I don't want to spoil it.
No, I don't want to spoil it either. I just think it's one of those missions that are cool. I mean, it felt an interesting...
It's a good mix of the superhero universe rules.
Yes. Yeah. And I will say all the core members get their moment.
Yeah.
I feel like Harley Quinn has given a really good few moments. You get a capture of her psyche.
Well, they chopped down the squad to only three people.
Yeah.
It's just Deadshot, Boomerang, and Harley.
Yeah. And I feel like...
And I assume that they will expand on that probably in the main book, but there they wanted to zero in on probably the biggest personality.
I mean, Waller even says that she, you know, you're going to have more people to sort of go in on it. But yeah, these are definitely the core members of the squad. And yeah, I mean, they feel like... I mean, Deadshot has a bit more armor to him.
Yeah.
But it feels like
that's
Deadshot...
That's not unlike versions of Deadshot, though. It's still the red and silver costume.
I kind of wish Boomerang was doing his more crikey and all of the
things. Me too, yeah.
A little bit thicker accent.
He feels a little bit just kind of there at times.
Boomerang, Australia's Boomerang is going to be hard to duplicate because, for one thing, they called him Captain Boomerang.
Yeah.
They acknowledged the goofiness of him. And that was sort of part of his charm, that he was surprisingly deadly, but on the surface he seemed like a joke. And I think they don't want to even have that hint of he might be a joke anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So they've just chopped it. They call him Boomerang. They show him being deadly. And the acknowledgement toward his goofiness is more of like he's a drinker and kind of a jerk.
Right.
Right.
And
probably
a
little bit closer, I'm guessing, to the movie personality.
Yeah.
And I kind of miss the goofy ruthlessness.
I do too.
But I did like how they portrayed Rob Williams, who... Why am I blanking on what else Rob Williams
He's done a ton of stuff.
Yeah, he's been... Did he do, like, the Suicide Squad for New 52 for a little bit?
No, I don't think so.
No, but I actually really liked, you know...
But you don't talk about the main thing for me here, which is they introduced Rick Flag.
Right. I mean, we said we introduced the character. I wanted to surprise people, but
it's in the first page.
All right, fine. Yes, they introduced Rick Flag to DC Rebirth universe.
I did not realize that New 52 had not brought him in, but I forgot. You pointed out, I guess, that, like, Steve Trevor had been...
Steve Trevor was sort of the guy in that role of the good guy spy.
Yeah, he was sort of Amanda Waller's go-to person. He was, like, running Justice League...
Just League of America.
Their counter team.
Yeah, their take on Flag, and I won't say too much specifics, I really liked.
I thought
this was a good take on him and a good reason why Waller would bring him on the team. It was interesting.
It's a good Rebirth issue.
Nick, you mentioned like all the characters kind of getting their moment.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that weirds me out sometimes when this doesn't happen in superhero books. Like, I feel like there's... Not to make it too much of a formula, and I understand people don't want to do that, but when you launch a title, and in the first issue, the hero kind of gets crushed or is, like, made to look weak, you know, just to show how bad the bad guys are or something like that, that always weirds me out. I'm like, don't you want people to, like, see the good guy, their main character, kind of at least get some cool moments?
Yeah, I'm worried about that, too.
Kick some butt.
It feels like sort of in the Detective
Comics. And so I'm happy to hear that they do in this.
Where Detective Comics, you know, all those characters get their moments, so.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I think there was this subversion that people used to do where, like, they do a first issue where the hero lost everything.
Right.
And as a subversion, it's interesting. But when everyone starts doing it, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, you're like, wait, these guys are supposed to be cool.
Yeah, as an occasional trick, it's a good trick. If you do it all the time, it becomes puzzling.
Right.
Nick, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is a book from Aftershock Comics.
Yep.
A book called Animosity. I don't know if this is a miniseries.
I don't either. It's Marguerite Bennett, who has done a bunch of stuff, including, I think, DC Bombshells.
Yep, and it's artist by Raphael de la Tour, which I think he did some X-Factor, if
I think I'm that's right. It's nice looking.
It's really beautiful. But it's sort of about a world where one day all the animals sort of gain sentience.
Yeah.
And if you can imagine some of what animals might do, you know.
Right, it's like they not only become, first of all, they gain the ability to speak.
To speak.
But also, they kind of like become aware of their situations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet they are also still essentially kind of have their animal instincts and their trains of thought.
Yeah, it sort of opens with a 3-page sort of progression montage of animals sort of...
I see there's like a Shamu SeaWorld kind of thing. There's like lab rats. There's a house
pandas,
cat.
There's two sloths.
The sloths used for comedic effect, and it's very funny.
Yeah, there's a cat crawling on top of his owner.
By the way, the thing that I found interesting about this, when the cow wakes up, I was like, oh man, you guys are trying to put me off hamburgers. That was intense.
Yeah.
That was a really good moment.
That one was really hard. The pandas was really difficult.
Yeah. Well, I know that for sure it's a book that's kind of wanting to make you think about sort of how we interact with animals.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that it does show them in a variety of different ways. It is not just a, hey, get ready to feel sad and depressed. There is some crazy humor. There's some dark humor. And there's some love, too.
I was going to say, it sort of covers a lot of emotions and sort of goes in different places that I wasn't expecting it to. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem to want to focus on a certain family and sort of their pet dog, which is a bloodhound, which is really, really... I want to say the art in here, it's all beautifully rendered. It's just gorgeous. Mm-hmm. All the animals have nice little sense of character and facial tics and...
animals that you would think might be scary sometimes are, and animals that you might not think of as scary sometimes do some scary things in this.
Exactly. But I don't want to give too much away, but I thought it was a really good first issue. I'm curious to see where Marguerite Bennett takes the story.
You know, I have to say, just a random aside mention, I had tried, Marguerite Bennett's been writing DC's Bombshells,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading that a little bit early on, and whatever I wanted from it, I wasn't getting out of it.
Right.
It wasn't that I felt like it was necessarily poorly written, but it was kind of dense and a little bit more serious than I expected. I read an issue randomly the other week, and I actually really liked that issue, and I kind of plugged more into the world-building stuff that she was doing. And so I'm thinking about giving that book another look.
Okay.
I think sort of, in a way, having seen a little bit more of the end game or with the through line on it,
Well, you were telling me some of the small stuff that's involved in sort of the character and backgrounds.
Right.
And I thought it was really cool with, like, the Catwoman stuff.
Yeah, Catwoman was like a... I think she was sort of like... There was a little bit of that, what was it? Like, if you've ever seen the movie Cabaret, that kind of... almost like bohemian Germans that were, like, in opposition to the Nazis.
But and sort of working undercover.
But she is, yeah, she seems to be collaborating, but is, in fact, like... poisoning them, knockout poison, I should say, not necessarily killing them, but to loot them. But I think she's like, you know, she's like funding like the French Resistance, and there's some you know rather elaborate stuff going on that will tie into like specific battles and things like that. So there's more history woven into this, and at the same time, there's some modern sensibilities like a open, you know, at least I think two open lesbian relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Harley and Ivy is one, and I think Batgirl and Montoya is the other. But it's almost like, you know how we kind of just took for granted in the Silver Age, all the heroes were guys?
Yeah.
It's just like, it was every once in a while a female hero would show up and it'd be like, oh, right, yeah, this is kind of just a gender swap of that, and it sort of has all the sort of romance and drama and elaborate, you know, details that you would expect from kind of like a wartime drama. It just happens that they're all women in it. It's such a weirdly, it is a little more weirdly serious because it's spun off of that like pinup statue line.
Well, and I will say DC has put a lot of sort of faith in this line because it's got a comic series. It did all the statues and it's continuing to do the statues.
Yep.
They're about to launch a line of Icon action figures.
Oh, really?
As well.
Yep. I didn't
and
know
the
that.
Four ones that they have to start with, Ivy, Wonder Woman, Batwoman, and...
Catwoman?
No. Why am I blanking on the last one?
I don't remember.
Harley.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah.
They all look just gorgeous and fantastic, and they're going to have sort of the articulation that we've come to expect. Oh, wow.
That's crazy. I did not know they were doing that.
So.
Anyway, it's just Marguerite Bennett's been on my mind lately. I'm glad that Animosity, and I enjoyed that first issue, too. And if I'm still digging it as I check through some of the trades, I'll report back.
I know she's a friend of many friends I have in comics, and everybody seems to love her.
Okay.
So she's definitely one of these up-and-comers. She's been doing a lot of stuff. My alt pick is Green Arrow number 4. For the story by Ben Percy, I'm occasionally frustrated with. I didn't like the sort of crash of – he had this really interesting status quo, and he just crashed it in issue 2.
Oh, right.
And then he brings in Diggle here, and there's this big sort of throwdown between Diggle and Arrow, and they're referencing something that happened, and they make no explanation as to what it was. Huh. So if you hadn't been reading before, this may be the hazard of putting on a guy who had been writing it pre-Rebirth. Like, I don't know what the fight was about. And that kind of thing bugs me. That said, there's some really great moments with Black Canary. They're bad guys. They're sort of creepy Court of Owls-esque type bad guys are really good. And Ollie gets to be cool. But the real selling point of this for me is the art. This has beautiful sort of painted-looking art from Juan Ferreira, who I realized as I was looking through this, oh, I know this guy. He did an image book called Smaller Gods like 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was like about psychic secret agents. Uh-huh. I remember even thinking back then, it was black and white, but it had this sort of watercolor look to it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wow, this guy's art is really good. It turns out that, yeah, he worked on Rex Mundi, Dark Horse, and he worked on Colder, Dark Horse. And then he started moving over to DC to work Gotham by Midnight, Constantine, Suicide Squad. And this seems to be sort of his chance to shine. And, man, is the art so good.
Oh, you know what? He must have been doing some of those. I remember I was looking at some of the last few issues of the previous Suicide Squad run. And I remember they had this really beautiful painted look. And so yeah, it must have been him.
It's got to be. But it's got this opening page. The credits page shows sort of a Green Arrow and Diggle facing off on this bridge. It's sort of got these Asian influences. The city's in the background. Then a couple pages later, there's a double page splash of Black Canary doing some cool action stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And it's just beautifully done.
It almost reminds me a little bit of how it might look if you had a very lush painted art style painted over the energetic pencils of Phil Hester,
yeah,
who did our, you know, what basically our favorite Green Arrow run.
Yeah.
Because it has some energy to it. You know how painted art can look stiff?
Can look stiff, yeah.
It doesn't look like that.
No. It is beautiful. And honestly, though the story has only mildly got my attention, as long as they're doing the art here, as long as he's one of the artists, I'll be keeping track of it because it is some beautiful comics artwork.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Also on my list this week, Jeff Steinberg, Champion of Earth, which is a wacky comedy in which a slacker is chosen to defend represent Earth. It's got art by our friend of the store, Tony Fleeks, from My Little Pony. And then Paper Girls number 8, the sort of, if you dug Stranger Things, and all right-thinking people did, right, Dave?
What?
If you dug Stranger Things, Paper Girls you should definitely give a shot at, because it's the same kind of mix of 80s and weird sci-fi and all that kind of thing. It's definitely drawing on some of the same influences. It also has a battle between two giant-sized tardigrades, water bears. So
we'll have to tell Teela about that, as she is tardigrade fan number 1.
It's also got fantastic art by Cliff Chang and continues to be really good. Vote Loki. This book is flying under so many people's radar, and I'm really enjoying it. It's basically the story of this journalist trying to catch Loki doing what she knows he's doing as he's running for president. Like, he's lying. He's doing it for villainous reasons. She knows it. He's even pretty open about it. But no matter what, she cannot seem to catch him in a scandal. And it's hilarious and kind of frustrating. And she's like, how can this guy be running for president and polling so high? Uh-huh. And I feel like there might be some nods to the real world
it
in that.
It may have a little bit of relevance.
But it's been really fun. It's a fun little miniseries. Moon Knight number 5 wraps up the big Moon Knight story I've been loving. It's got guest art from James Stocco, Francisco Francavilla, and Wilfredo Torres, all really good artists, as well as Greg Smallwood doing his usual stuff. And it gives you an answer as to what's been going on and then leads immediately into another question. So I'm really liking this book. I would like at some point to know what's going on in it, but for right now they've got my attention. Doctor Strange number 10 wraps up the Last Days of Magic story in fine fashion. Worth noting that Chris Bacala stayed on all 10 issues.
That's pretty impressive.
And then
is that going to continue, or is he going to go like take a hiatus now? He is not an artist who usually does long runs.
I know that the next issue is by somebody else. I feel like it's the Kevin Nolan. Maybe he's doing a full issue.
Okay.
And then Bacala, I think, will be back.
Huh?
So we'll see.
He must be really having a good time.
And then Civil War II Kingpin number 2 is a really interesting look at the sort of the crime side of the Marvel Universe and what happens when the heroes can predict crime and how does the biggest crime lord in Manhattan deal with that.
Guessing he's not wild about it.
He's not crazy about it, but he's got a solution, and that's what the story's about.
Interesting.
Dave, what else is on your list?
Let's see. Most of the other stuff that I've been reading was DC Rebirth stuff, so I'm going to maybe just quick just go through the other titles. I haven't read all of these, but there's Justice League number 2, Green Lanterns number 4, Batman number 4, Nightwing number 2, and one of the debut ones, Harley Quinn gets her first issue. So that's right. There's sort of the all things Suicide Squad related getting their first issues here.
Again, it's almost like there's a movie opening this weekend.
Almost as if. I do want to point out to people who are interested in checking out the new character who's going to be taking over the Iron Man suit or doing in some way replacing him. I guess I don't know exactly the specifics of it.
Nope.
But she's getting some prominent backstory stuff in this Invincible Iron Man 12 is the one I was referencing. So for those who are wanting to find out what her deal is, this and the issues that immediately precede it, actually off and on for the last, I think, 6 issues or so, are the ones you're going to want to look at. And I do think she's going to end up being a really pretty big thing. So, and last, I did want to mention one of those big old Elseworlds compilations hits this week that covers Superman crossover specifically with Dark Horse Comics. So this has both Superman Aliens miniseries.
Yep.
I remember I found the first one a little bit disappointing, but I ended up liking the second one more, where a ship filled with aliens crashes on Apocalypse.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit more larger than life, and it is a fourth world story with the new gods and Apocalypse and Superman and stuff. There's also the Madman crossover with a... I can't say his name.
Mike Allred.
Mike Allred's creation, Madman. One of the really fun cult comics of the 90s and 2000s. And culminates in the Superman Tarzan Sons of the Jungle.
Sure.
Written by Chuck Dixon with that weird art by Carlos Meglia.
Yeah.
That's very, very sort of cartoony. I actually never read this. I'm curious to read it more because of Dixon than Meglia, whose art I'm not wild about.
As I recall, I liked it quite a bit.
But the interesting thing is that it's like if you've seen Disney's Tarzan, which has a great visual aesthetic, it's for sure riffing on that at least a little bit and has some of that those qualities. So there are some fun stories in here, and even the ones that, like, that's first Superman Aliens, which are not great, has some interesting ideas, like Superman far away from Earth, his power's fading, and he's actually vulnerable to the potential aliens, both the big ones and the facehuggers. Yeah. So there's some interesting stuff in there for y'all Supes fans.
Nick, what did we miss?
There was a Daredevil annual this week, which is notable because it's the return of the character Echo.
Yeah.
Beautiful artwork by Vanessa Del Rey.
Yeah.
It was very good. One of the Rebirth titles that Dave missed.
My bad, Superman. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, this is Superman, Tomasi and Gleason, continuing to fight the Eradicator. But there is a surprise guest appearance from a character from Hitman.
Who is it? I heard y'all talking about it.
Yeah, that is just awesome.
If you haven't read Hitman, this is... You're probably not going to know anything about this character.
Nope.
But
it's just fun to see.
That is actually nod. One of the deepest cuts I've ever seen.
And then there was a cool one shot. It's not a one shot because it's leading into some characters.
But like standalone issue?
Standalone issue by of Spidey, the sort of all ages Spider-Man comic by Robbie Thompson, who wrote Silk. And I forget who this artist is, but the art is by Nathan Stockman. But this is basically Spider-Man versus Kraven the Hunter, which I always have a fun time seeing sort of the kind of action and kind of fisticuffs that can come out of that battle.
They're good adversaries.
They are. And this is a lot of fun. Reminded me a lot of why I like Spider-Man. Definitely at this age where he's sort of just has his job with the Bugle and doing all that stuff. But
I'm enjoying the classic.
As much as I love Dan Slott's kind of sort of Peter Parker businessman, I do kind of enjoy just the traditional one as well.
Right.
But that is it.
All right. That wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about some movies and another video series. It feels like it's been a while since we did these topic overviews, but I guess it has only been a couple weeks. We did catch up recently.
There was like a few weeks ago that like we held off on, but it was like I remember I had seen what was that movie, Lights Out?
Yeah,
and I was like, you know, I kind of enjoyed it, but I don't really have a lot to say about it. It's a fun B grade horror movie, but not great.
Yeah.
But we have missed doing them for a few weeks. I think.
So we're gonna talk about a few movies. Before we do that, I watched Harmon Quest episode 1. This is on YouTube. It's a CISO show. Do you guys know about CISO?
No, I've not.
It's this, I think it's NBC's like comedy channel. Mm. So it's like a channel you can subscribe to. It's like $3.99 a month or something. And it's got all kinds of original comedy series by comedians, as well as comedy specials, reruns of NBC's classic comedies, that kind of thing. It's one of those things, if I had the time, I'd consider it, because it seems like they got some good stuff. But one of the things they've got is called Harmon Quest, which is a spinoff of Dan Harmon's podcast, Harmontown, where he used to play D&D on stage with his co-manager, Jeff Davis, and his girlfriend, then wife, now ex-wife.
Still on the show,
Aaron McGathy. Yeah. And then their DM, Spencer Crittenden, who became their DM. And this guy, Spencer is, if you say DM, this is what you picture. He's like a kind of a big guy. He's a bearded dude. He's got that weird sort of introverted thing, but at the same time, he was extroverted enough to like put his hand up and come run D&D for them that night because he had D20s in his pocket. He just happened to have them. And he's a really interesting guy. He was actually on the last season of Community playing Annie's brother.
Hmm.
And so basically they spun off from Harmontown. They went ahead and stopped doing D&D on that podcast. And now they're doing an animated show where they play D&D and then they animate the sequences. And their guest on this is Paul F. Tompkins, comedian Paul F. Tompkins, and they're starting a new campaign where they are all villagers in this sort of half-orc village, and there's a ritual that's about to go off. It's like a seasonal ritual. It gets interrupted by bad guys, and then there's combat. And it's just them sort of riffing and playing D&D and being funny, and then it being animated, and it's just the perfect version of that kind of thing.
Huh.
And it's like half an hour long, so it's not like these super long, like 3-hour playthroughs. So if someone wanted to get a sense of what D&D is like playing with friends, this is the thing I'd point them to. If someone wanted to see something kind of funny, you know, in that vein, I'd point them to that too. It was really funny. The first episode is free on YouTube. I definitely recommend anyone with any gaming interest at all give this a look because I thought it was pretty hilarious. I also went and saw Ghostbusters, which I know Nick saw.
I've seen it twice.
We saw it twice. Mm-hmm. Wow! So between the three of us, we've all seen it once.
They could think you're cool for seeing a movie twice, but I will point out that I saw 10 Cloverfield Lane 3 times in the last few weeks.
Did you really?
Yeah. First time I saw it and liked it. Then I thought that it might have some stuff in it that my mom would like, so I showed it to her. And then I happened to be over at a friend's place, and they were looking at like pay-per-view stuff, and I was like, "Oh, 10 Cloverfield Lane, that was a good movie." And I kind of jokingly, I was like, "If y'all happen to want to watch it, I'd catch it again." And they're like, "All right, let's watch it." I did not get tired of it on a third viewing, so I will say, although I actually do have some problems, mostly just with sort of the ending, I really find that movie super watchable.
That's interesting, because I liked it, but I didn't know if I liked it well enough to see it again.
There's certain kind of suspense tropes, stuff that's like very Hitchcocky, you know, the kind of like isolated scenario, and I like movies also where like I feel like every line actually has some merit. Everything kind of comes full circle in this. Nothing is mentioned that doesn't get referenced somewhere later. Even the opening sequence where you see this girl packing up to like run off from her boyfriend.
Yeah.
There's a lot of visual information packed in there. You know, as the camera pans across her apartment, you get all kinds of information that will be later referenced, and you just don't know it yet at the time.
Okay.
So, although the ending, I had a few issues with some of the believability of it, it also had some things I really liked. So I don't want to spoil it by talking about any specifics, but anyway. Didn't mean to interrupt and segue there.
But you saw Cloverfield Lane 3 times, but you have not made time to watch Ghostbusters.
Correct.
But you should, because it's really good.
I've been kind of trying to see it. I saw Star Trek.
Yeah, you saw Star Trek.
Yeah. So Ghostbusters.
So Nick has already talked about this a little bit, sort of non-spoilery, and I will keep it fairly spoiler-free, but my daughter wanted to see it. And I've been kind of wanting to see it, but yeah. I wasn't like going to go out of my way, but she wanted to see it, so we went and saw it at the Draft House, and I loved it. I was not sure if I was going to like it that much, because I love Ghostbusters. I didn't have any particular attachment to seeing a reboot or not seeing a reboot, yeah. but I was like, the trailers weren't doing anything for me.
I think you had more of a problem with Paul Feig.
Yeah, I don't like a lot of Paul Feig's movies.
Right.
But I liked Spy well enough, so I decided to go ahead and see this, and what the trailer sort of promised me is sort of what I got. But Penny,
Kate McKinnon.
Leslie Jones.
Leslie Jones.
Leslie Jones' character was much more than the trailer made her out to be. Yes. She's a really great character, and Kate McKinnon's Holtzman just steals the movie.
She does.
I could sense that from the trailers.
Yeah, she was the character my daughter loved. Like, that was her favorite character. But also, Chris Hemsworth plays sort of a doofy guy. He plays what would it be in a standard movie? He's
the sexy, but
yeah. And I love that they flipped that. I love that they went in. He's,
did they do it in such a way that it? I mean, did it feel mean spirited? Did it feel like
no?
Shut up and sit down, man.
No, he was definitely dumb.
It was spoofing the trope.
Yeah. He's lovably dumb.
How tonally similar is it to the original Ghostbusters?
Not very. I think it leans
There's
a little
some
more.
Beats. I heard people say actiony, like a little
it's,
more. Action-y.
I was going to say it's more actiony than comedy.
Yes,
okay. That's how I read it. It's more action comedy than comedy
that's
comedy.
Interesting.
And I think that it's hard to compare a Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ivan Reitman.
That's
Harold
like
Ramis joint.
Yeah.
Like you can't compare that to anything else.
Right.
But this was really fun. I think the lead characters, Kristen Wiig's character and Melissa McCarthy's character, are the weakest characters.
Interesting.
They're played fairly straight, and there's not a lot to them, I think, unfortunately. Uh-huh. But Holtzman is great.
I didn't really have an issue with either of the characters.
I don't have an issue, but I also couldn't tell you their names.
Right.
I don't know the names of either character off the top of my head.
Yeah, no, that's about
Whereas
right.
I remember Penny, and I remember Holtzman.
Yeah.
So, and there's...
the first time I saw the original Ghostbusters, I might remember Egon or something like that because it's such a weird name. But I don't think, as much as I loved it, I don't think I particularly remember their names.
Oh, okay. Well, I liked this a lot, and I thought that some of the action beats were really good. There's a great action sequence where they're fighting the ghost at the end that is just a great action sequence.
Spoiler warning.
And, right, they fight ghosts, sorry.
What? But I sort of like their sort of interpretation of the weaponry of Ghostbusters.
Me too.
They actually go to it with a little bit more. There's a lot more gadgets involved, which I think is really cool.
Their villain, I thought, was really good. It's also, I almost wonder if they knew ahead of time if they were going to get the backlash that they got.
I've heard about this
because their villain is sort of this stunted
man-child
dude, and he's very entitled and very sort of misogynist, and he feels like a reaction to.
I kind of like the notion that they had something else completely in mind. They had a big villain or whatever, but then like the very just like from the announcement
the
of
it,
we're changing.
The dude bros were freaking out,
and
they're like, "I've got another idea. Let's do one more pass at this script."
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case. I mean, maybe that was reshoots.
Like you could probably know that it was coming if you kind of know people.
Yeah, that's probably true. At any rate, I found it hilarious, and I really liked the movie. So I don't know how it's doing there. Of course, it's hard to get
heard ups and downs, but I think it's doing all right.
It's hard to get a real sense on the internet of how things are doing because there's this active campaign to say it's doing badly.
Right.
But
I think it's doing well enough that we're going to get a sequel.
I want a sequel because I want more of these characters, and I want a Ghostbusters 2 that's good. Sorry, Ghostbusters 2 fans. It's true.
It's not great, but I still have a lot of fun with it.
You mentioned all the gadgets and stuff. How have they been merchandising this much? And if not, do you think they will? And that could easily,
Does have a toy line that has found some hard to find figures.
Do they beyond the figures though? Do they have like is there proton packs and like some of these gadgets you're talking about?
They do have proton packs. I haven't seen like the trap. I mean, as a kid, the trap as a Ghostbuster was one of my favorite things.
I did not have that. I would have killed to have had that as a kid.
But yes, proton packs exist. Funko Pop has a great line of the figures of their own.
Right.
That I think has, like, the new Ecto-1 and stuff like that. But, yeah, I think this will get a sequel. I really do.
I hope so. I liked it, and I want to see more of these characters. I especially think they could deepen the main two and do a lot more with Holtzman.
And I did like the nods to the original as well.
Sure.
All the cameos and things like that.
Yeah, the cameos. Some people really complained they did not like the number of cameos, and I was expecting to be overwhelmed by them, but really all it is that all three of the remaining living Ghostbusters are in it.
Yeah.
In, like, tiny roles.
And there's
Were they, like, the kind where they appear, like, sort of Stan Lee style and they nudge-nudge, wink-wink at the camera?
One of them, one of them was definitely a nudge-nudge, wink-wink. One of them was actually a character that made sense to be there. And the other one was, I mean, Bill Murray's role is a character that belongs in the movie.
Yeah.
All superior to Quentin Tarantino's various cameos.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, and the little nods they had I thought were good nods. And so I really liked this one. Nick, you saw a couple movies this weekend.
I did. One was Campy as Hell, when that is Independence Day Resurgence.
Yep.
It showed up at our Dollar Theater, which 94. I have to say, I really like our Dollar Theater. It's really good. The one that took the place of the Alamo Draft House, Lake Creek.
Yeah.
It's good.
That's good. I occasionally go to the one up here in Round Rock, and it's okay.
but yeah, no, this is Roland Emmerich doing his Independence Day riff. I mean, it followed a lot of the same plot points.
Now, the part of the interesting thing is Independence Day, I don't know how long they get to things blowing up, but I bet it's at least a half hour. But of like kind of like character building, you know, because he does those big ensemble. He does disaster movies.
That's true.
And does this kind of do of that ahead of time?
I know it's
30... a weird alternate future where we've used their tech and stuff, right?
Yeah, basically it takes place 20 years, or actually real time. So how long was it? 99? When
something like that, yeah.
So however long it was.
15,
20 years. And we've co-opted their technology and sort of used it to better ourselves, better technology, made better planes and stuff that actually can like go into outer space. So there's sort of this evolution of technology, and of course we still have Jeff Goldblum, Bill Pullman is in it.
Life finds a way.
Brett Spiner definitely...
Wait, Brett Spiner died in the first movie.
No, he did not.
That alien grabbed him, and I thought it snapped his neck before it flung him away.
It did not snap his neck, apparently.
Because it sounded
like... He was in a coma for 20 years.
Okay, that's a retcon, because if you go back and watch Independence Day...
I know, I watched it recently.
It snaps his neck, and then it talks through him.
It just talks through him. From what...
I'm not buying, Nick. They retconned it.
I don't think they did, because I watched it very recently, like within the last month.
Well, I don't remember. I suppose part of it depends on the nebulous nature of the alien's psychic abilities and stuff like that. Like, can they only control dead people? Can they control...
No, they can control living people.
Living people, and that's made sort of more apparent in this one, because that has a lot to deal with. Backstory. This also has to deal with other alien civilizations, which I actually thought was kind of cool.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of a Mass Effect vibe to it, which was neat.
Oh, that's crazy. I didn't know that they went into that territory. That makes me actually more interested to see it. So
I'm not going to tell you more, but I had a lot of fun with it. It was dopey at times, but so was the original one.
So,
sure, it's only a question of, like, does it descend into, like, real stupidity?
I never felt like it delved into complete stupidity.
So, the thing is, everyone else I've talked to seemed to have thought this movie was terrible.
Yeah.
So I'm skeptical of you, but I want to believe, Nick.
Well, I went in with, like, no expectations.
It's probably best to stay that way.
Okay. I just went in. I wanted something fun to watch. I had popcorn. I had a Coke. I was laughing at stupid things. Don't get me wrong. And it probably is something to rent on Redbox or...
So what you're saying is when it shows up on HBO, I should probably go ahead and watch it.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I have a question. I know Will Smith is not in it. Do they explain that stuff?
Yes, he is referenced, and...
I knew the comic touched on it. I just wasn't sure whether they were going to bring it up.
The main,
or was it a sore spot in the
One
movie.
Of the main characters is his son.
His son, that's right.
So, and Will Smith is definitely... he's there in spirit.
Brent Spiner has not shown up a lot. That's in a lot of things.
No, but he's a major player in the
movie.
Cool.
And you said, like, Judd Hirsch is in it. Like, I kind of like that some of these guys who are, like, you know, character actors or, you know, actors whose careers have not skyrocketed in those intervening years, that they seems like they're getting pretty decent roles out of it.
I know Harvey Fierstein can't be back because he got blown up.
No, unfortunately.
Did he get blown up? How did
he get blown up? He was in the building, or
he was in his car.
Yeah, or something, yeah.
Okay.
And the aliens blew everything up.
He didn't make it.
And then the other movie I saw was a Netflix thing. It was an Alamo Drafthouse pick, and the movie is called The Invitation.
Mm-hmm.
It is a weird movie. I can't wholeheartedly recommend it, but it stuck with me so much that I have to talk about it just briefly. But it's about a couple, basically a husband who's been, his child passed away some years ago. He's still having trouble getting over it. His wife has sort of had moved on with another guy, and they get this invitation to a dinner party out of the blue, just sort of connect together with old friends. And it's about just like there's a cult sort of involved. They come together, and this couple who's throwing the dinner party shows them like this video, and it kind of weirds everyone out, but they're kind of, it's just this,
it sounds unpredictable in the sense that I can see what would sound like something starting out as a drama about, you know, an estranged couple ending up at the dinner, it's a dinner party together, and that's awkward. And then suddenly this weird, other weird stuff starts to happen.
Yeah, and it's like,
that sounds interesting at least.
And it just builds tension upon tension. And there's these weird but very palpable scenes with human interaction, just kind of like dealing with very weird things, like bringing up subject matter that you probably would never do at a dinner party.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of,
is that
just
a stylization of the film, or is there, it has something to do with the plot?
I mean, it's both plot and stylization of the film. It's very just taut. It builds tension throughout the entire movie until it finally explodes.
And you likened it a little bit when we were talking to some of the edginess of Green Room.
A little bit.
Who's kind of edge, I have to say, I didn't like.
I would say it's not as in your face nor as upfront about it.
Uh-huh.
I feel like there's a little bit more characterization to all of the characters. They get you sort of to like them a little bit more, mm-hmm. where I felt Green Room was kind of just like, okay, here's the setup, and go with all the violence.
Right, right.
This one has a little bit more to it. And there are some gut punches towards the end that I was surprised. I would say watch it, but it's not going to be for everyone.
Yeah. You know, chances are it'll cross my path at some point, and I'll at least, you know, watch 10, 15 minutes, see what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
All right. That about wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.